This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Pacifica Foundation, WBAI Radio, General Post Office, P.O. Box 30540, New York, New York, 10017-2112. That's Pacifica Foundation, WBAI Radio, General Post Office, P.O. Box 30540, New York, New York, 10017-2112. Thanks for supporting your peace and justice community station, WBAI 99.5 FM.
Okay, and with that, it is exactly midnight here in New York City, and you are tuned to listener-supported, non-commercial, WBAI 99.5 FM. Big thanks to everybody out there who gave it up for Delphine Blue and Shocking Blue. Big ups to you, too. So, you'll have your opportunity to give it up for the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade next week, not right now. Because we're pitching next week, not this week. So you've got 1 week to get that pencil sharpened to write those checks. But meanwhile, do stay tuned for this. Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Anarchism for the global city. Radical environmentalism for the concrete jungle. Esoteric explorations of the secret history of rebel culture. Every Tuesday at midnight, after the news, on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI, 99.5 FM.
Yeah.
Welcome aboard to the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City. Once again, thanks to everybody who gave it up for Delphine in the last couple of hours. You're going to have your opportunity to give it up for the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade next week. Big ups to the volunteers back there who took people's calls. I'm not going to harp on it now because we're going to have more than an opportunity to harp on it next week. But WBAI is in deep financial crisis. This is a very critical moment. And if you want us to stick around to be a voice for free speech and a voice ultimately for you, you know what to do, right? So that's all I'm going to say about it. Say more about it next week, and we'll have a special guest next week, and we'll be hawking a special premium. It's a book. It's very interesting. It's very apropos to the current world crisis. So you're going to want to check it out. But also, I want to prevail upon you that you've really got the pledge next week because you need to make me feel loved and appreciated because I feel very dissed at the moment and very depressed. Part of what we're going to be talking about tonight is the real-world circumstances which have got me down. And then maybe we'll take phone calls and some of you can try to lift my spirits. Sorry. Okay, we were opening up with the same piece of music that we closed with last week. Just had to hear it again because I love it so much. That is Shruti Sadolikar Katkar, immediately followed by an instrumental by the Sarod virtuoso, Buddhadev Das Gupta, and immediately followed by a piece of traditional Rajasthani music, Artist Unknown. So, if you want to, by the way, a big shout out to Jason Goodrow, who laid all this wonderful classical Indian music on the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. And if you want to know more about classical ragas, he's got a great page. He's got a raga page on his website, Jason does. OpenCities.com, I believe, is the website. Have I got that right? No, one in the singular, OpenCity.com/raga. Or you can just go to the entry for tonight's show on our website, morc.info, and you can get there very easily. And certainly, Shruti Sadolikar, who we opened with, has certainly got a golden voice. My goodness. And we're playing this music, of course, continuing to play this music in solidarity with the victims of Mumbai. And I'll tell you, a part of what's got me down is the really predictable responses which I got when we took phone calls last week on the whole question. And additionally, the fact that, for all of the knee-jerk conspiracy mongering that we got, nobody expressed any appreciation or interest in the wonderful music that we played. So I have to continue to tell myself that the people who call in don't represent a representative cross-section of the listeners out there. Because, I do run into people out there in the real world from time to time who tell me, you're the guy who plays all that great music. So somebody appreciates what I do. And I do get thoughtful letters in the mail from time to time. I got a letter in the mail today. Thank you to the listener who sent the letter. I'll be responding to it on a future show. It's not what we're talking about tonight, but thank you for showing that you're paying attention and that you actually cared enough to literally put pen to paper, because it wasn't even, imagine that, it wasn't even written on a computer. It was actually written with a pen and paper, old school way. So let's see. Okay, before we get into the meat and potatoes of the show, or the tempeh and potatoes for you vegetarians out there, let me not be remiss and cut straight to the all-important announcement, which is that the 1 week from tonight, on December 16th, which is the same night which I'll be on these airwaves with an author doing an interview to raise money for WBAI, earlier in that evening, I will be at the annual Chaos Day lecture at the Libertarian Book Club's Anarchist Forum, featuring the Hierophant Emeritus of this radio show, the one, the only, the elusive, the inimitable, Peter Lamborn Wilson, who is going to be speaking once again on a theme which is extremely appropriate to the current world crisis, the magic of money and the future of capitalism. Peter Lamborn Wilson on finance as a form of Gnosticism, a long historical view of the current crisis and the prospects for resistance and revolution in the 21st century. So you're going to want to be there, hear what Peter has to say, especially you old timers who have been listening to this radio show for a long time and miss Peter and think that I'm just this pipsqueak with pretensions of filling his very, very large shoes. Well, this will be your opportunity, since he's probably never going to be on the radio again. This will be your opportunity to check him out in the flesh. And for those of you who are not old timers and don't remember 10, 15 years ago when Peter was talking on the air, well, this will be your opportunity to find out what the hype is all about. So be there 1 week from tonight, 7 p.m. It's going to be happening at the Living Theater. The Living Theater is at 21 Clinton Street between Houston and Stanton. Or is it Rivington? No, I think it's Stanton. Yes, right, between Houston and Stanton. Yes, on the Lower East Side. So if you're coming from uptown, take the F to 2nd Avenue and walk south. Or if you're coming from downtown, take the F or the M to Delancey and walk north. So once again, that's going to be Peter Lamborn Wilson giving his special Chaos Day lecture on the magic of money and the future of capitalism. And this is going to be this is not going to be a get rich quick seminar, as the name The Magic of Money might imply. He's going to be taking a very critical view of the magic of money, and I believe talking about how placing one's faith in the financial system is engaging in magical thinking. I believe that that is more to his point, and that the what keeps afloat the financial markets is a form of mass psychosis. Perhaps it's a paradoxical glimmer of hope that it's starting to wear thin at the moment. Well, we'll have more to say about paradoxical glimmers of hope. Once again, 1 week from tonight, Tuesday, December 16th, 7 p.m. at the Living Theater, 21 Clinton Street, which is between Houston and Stanton on the Lower East Side. Be there or be terribly, terribly square, and see you there. I seem to be talking in rhyme tonight. That's pretty scary. Pretty scare-y. Okay, so let's see. What else is scary? Well, what else is scary has been the whole reaction to the horrific events in Mumbai. Been quite scary. And, well, I mean, some of it has been scary in a predictable way. For instance, the rumors now that extensively reported in the press in the subcontinent, both in India and Pakistan, that when Condoleezza Rice stopped in Islamabad, she was told by Pakistan's leadership behind closed doors that they had been explicitly threatened with military action by India in the aftermath of the attacks, and that New Delhi intended to teach Pakistan a lesson, quote unquote. And there were also reports in the media in the subcontinent, once again, not corroborated. We don't know what to believe, but the mere fact that it's being reported indicates a certain level of paranoia and brinksmanship, which is quite terrifying. Also reported that Condoleezza Rice herself, behind closed doors of the Pakistani leadership, threatened military intervention in somewhat veiled terms, basically said that, well, you know, we're trying to restrain India and we're trying to restrain Israel, and Israel also lost nationals in the Mumbai attacks, and sort of said that, you know, these countries have been, you know, chomping at the bit for military action, and we've been trying to restrain them. So, you know, if you don't act, they will, and if they don't, the U.S. will. All right, that was actually put in quotes by, well, unnamed Pakistani officials talking to the press in both India and Pakistan, that if you don't act, the U.S. will, quote unquote. And subsequently, Pakistan did act and took out a camp in Pakistan-controlled Kashmir belonging to this group Lashkar-e-Taiba, which is believed to have been behind the attacks. And this is a group which, you know, going back 10 or 15 years, was actually groomed by Pakistani intelligence to make trouble in Indian-controlled Kashmir. So going after it and taking out its camp in a military raid is going to further heighten the contradictions in Pakistan, shall we say. And is going to make the jihadist elements, including those within the military and intelligence apparatus, feel more and more betrayed and increase their level of hostility both to India and to the United States. And typically, of course, there have been all these questions as to whether the raids were real or not. And there's all these claims that the leadership of Lashkar-e-Taiba are still being protected by the Pakistani state, and that these camps which were taken out were essentially empty, and they were never really used for military purposes anyway, but just for educational and indoctrinational purposes, and that the real military camps have not been touched. So once again, one doesn't know what to believe, but one does get a sense of the direction that things are going by reading the accounts. And these are not accounts from, you know, fringe conspiracy websites. These are accounts from the Times of India and Dawn, which is one of the major daily newspapers in Pakistan, and so on, right? Just the mainstream press on the subcontinent get a somewhat different picture from what you're getting in the mainstream press in this country. And then I'll tell you what really got me down was the protests which were held in Mumbai in the immediate aftermath of the attacks, which brought out thousands to the streets, where people were calling for more police with bigger guns, more checkpoints, you know, ratcheting up security, et cetera, et cetera. And I suppose, you know, I mean, I don't want to judge too harshly, okay, because, you know, the attacks didn't happen in my city. Although I will say that when attacks did happen in my city, I was opposing and continue to oppose, you know, the ratcheting up of the security state in response. But I suppose if I had, you know, lost a loved one in the attacks, I might feel differently. But I do think that in any event, it's unfortunate and demoralizing that people are out there literally marching in the streets demanding more police, bigger guns, more military checkpoints, et cetera, et cetera. And as if that wasn't bad enough, many of the protesters, according to the press accounts, calling for military action against Pakistan. That's really quite scary. So that's a part of what's been getting me down. And on, you know, a very related theme, you know, unfortunately, is, you know, this whole knee-jerk conspiranoid response, which we've just heard from every quarter, including when I took phone calls on WBAI. You know, of course, in India, the way the knee-jerk conspiranoid line plays out among the, particularly among the Hindu right and the nationalists and so on, is that, you know, it was all carried out by Pakistan. except for, you know, you've got the dissidents and the gadflies and the ultra-leftists in India who are saying that it was actually carried out by the Hindu right in conjunction with the CIA and Mossad. And nobody has really marshaled too much evidence for any of these conclusions, and yet everybody clings to their pet theory with, you know, absolute rigid dogmatism. And just by way of illustration as to how out of whack the whole conspiracy mentality has gotten, well, in the days after the attacks, actually, there were ethnic riots, very, very violent, in Karachi, Pakistan's port city and the second biggest city in the country, pitting Urdu speakers against Pashtuns, the Pashtuns mostly being economic migrants from the northwest of the country, the borderlands along the border with Afghanistan, and many of them, in fact, being refugees from Afghanistan. You know, like economic migrants anywhere, including here in New York City. And we just witnessed another case just after the one in Long Island a couple of weeks ago. There was just one in Brooklyn over the weekend of an Ecuadorian being killed by knee-jerk xenophobe thugs. So essentially the same sort of scapegoating. And ugly us-versus-them groupthink seemed to be playing itself out in Karachi, where the more, local Urdu-speaking populace was being pitted against the economic migrants who were Pashtuns. And there were several days of violence in Karachi, which left around 50 dead. And Pakistan's former prime minister and a real sort of political big shot in the country, Nawaz Sharif, raised his own conspiracy theory that the violence in Karachi had been instrumented by the Indian intelligence services as retribution for the attacks in Mumbai. Now, does this make a lick of sense? Not that I can see. Did he marshal any evidence whatsoever in support of this claim? No. So, isn't this just utterly irresponsible just to throw this out? And just, you know, heightening up the whole level of paranoia and bellicosity, which could well lead to war, could well escalate in the weeks ahead of us. So this is just a particularly egregious example. But, all of the stuff I get from the callers to this radio show who are immediately assuming that the CIA or Mossad instrumented the whole thing, I mean, they're just engaging in exactly the same kind of thinking. Now, I'm not going to go on about it too much because I have other things I want to talk about, including a few things out there which are sort of a glimmer of hope. And I could really use a few glimmers of hope. And once again, I would like to think that the people who call in don't represent a representative cross-section. There I go, using that redundant construction once again. They don't represent a representative cross-section. I could just say they aren't a representative cross-section. That would be a more concise way of saying it, wouldn't it? Of the listeners. And that may be the ones who, I run into at the BAI board meetings and so on, who tell me, oh, you're the guy who plays that wonderful music. Maybe they're the more representative listeners. Well, it's 12:32 in the a.m. on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City. My name is Bill Weinberg. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. And you know what? Maybe we will take some phone calls just to see if there's anybody out there who will break the mold. Or, you know, I suppose if you really feel that, you need to take me to task. A lot of people out there accuse me of being condescending. You know, I really try to be good. I really do. And I really feel that, you know, those of you or many of you who accuse me of being condescending need to cast the beam from thine own eye, because nobody is more condescending than all of you conspiranoids out there who are convinced that, you know, anybody who doesn't buy into your baseless theories is just, you know, one of the sheeple, as you so charmingly put it, the sheeple instead of the people. You've heard that word, right? And is just, you know, a rube and is indoctrinated and blah, 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 because we actually believe in looking at evidence and letting the facts speak for themselves. How terribly old-fashioned, I know. All right, well, let's talk about some of the things out there which have actually given me hope. Well, I'll tell you one thing which really gave me hope is that there were more marches in Mumbai and other cities in India, Bangalore, Delhi, Hyderabad, Ahmedabad, and others over the weekend, organized by a group called Muslims for Secular Democracy. But not only, and this is quite significant, this march was not only made up of, modern thinking secularist Muslims, but also was joined by more traditional conservative Muslim organizations and clerics and mullahs, came together in explicit repudiation of terrorism and marched 100 strong in all of those cities in India, and in Mumbai actually held a silent march, which is always a very, very powerful tactic. If you really want to let people know that you're dead serious, hold a silent march, okay? As opposed to getting out there and chanting, 1, 2, 3, 4, leftist rallies are a bore. More mindless chants, more mindless chants. Instead of doing that, you know, get out there and hold a march in dead silence, and people will really, really know that you're serious. And that's what they did in Mumbai. In complete silence, they marched through the streets and they visited every one of the sites which had been targeted for the attacks on what now is becoming known in India as 26/11, November 26th. Under the slogan, killers of innocents are enemies of Islam. And in complete, unequivocal repudiation of Lashkar-e-Taiba and all the other outfits out there who have been carrying out atrocities like this in the name of Islam. And not engaging in any conspiracy theorist, oh, it was really our political enemies who did it. But just repudiating terrorism and not even worrying about who did it. That's the most important thing, is to restore some kind of sense of humanity. Far more important than, you know, pointing fingers of blame at this particular moment. I mean, certainly, yes, I believe in looking very, very closely at the actual facts and trying to ascertain as best we can who a, you know, likely actor behind this might have been. But ultimately, more imperative than that is just restoring a sense of humanity. And particularly since the attacks were ostensibly, at a minimum, carried out by Islamist extremists, to make clear that they weren't acting in the name of Islam. Just as when U.S. imperialism carries out atrocities, we as people who live in the belly of the beast have got to make clear that this is not happening in our name. So that's one thing which has given me a certain sense of hope. And, you know, it has to be said that the immediate protests in Mumbai, where people were calling for more police and more military checkpoints and for military action against Pakistan, brought out thousands, whereas the Muslim march in repudiation of terrorism only brought out hundreds. That has to be said. But I'll take what I can get. You know, I'll take what I can get in terms of glimmers of hope. And that was a glimmer of hope. And another glimmer of hope is that there haven't been any significant outbreaks of communal violence in India, of sectarian violence in India, in the aftermath of the Mumbai attacks. And in fact, December 6th was a very significant day in India. It was the anniversary of the 1992 Ayodhya attack, in which a bunch of Hindu militants destroyed a mosque, not with explosives, but with jackhammers and pickaxes and so on, but destroyed it just the same because it was built during the Mughal era on a Hindu holy site. And that occasioned a great deal of sectarian violence over the years since 1992. And particularly the anniversary, December 6th, has been an occasion for sectarian violence in India. And it came and went largely without incident. There were a few protests and so on, but there was no violence. Protests both by Hindus and by Muslims. Hindus demanding that the site be turned over to them to build a temple to Rama, and Muslims demanding that that the mosque be rebuilt. So there were protests on both sides, but there wasn't any violence. So maybe, just maybe, 2611 has sort of served as a wake-up call in India. That, well, you know, things are getting a little bit out of hand, and we really have to restore some humanity and a sense of common humanity as opposed to, you know, just viewing things entirely through the prism of, you know, Hindu versus Muslim, Muslim versus Hindu, blah, 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 blah. And I should also point out that while the ethnic clashes which took place in Karachi in Pakistan, well, you know, this Pakistani politicians tried to make hay out of them and link them to the Mumbai attacks. They really weren't linked to the Mumbai attacks at all. And in fact, it was Muslim versus Muslim. It had nothing to do with the Mumbai attacks or the whole Hindu versus versus Muslim thing. So that's a glimmer of hope, I suppose. And there have been a few other things which have been getting me down a little bit closer to home, and also some glimmers of hope a little bit closer to home as well. And, well, of the things which have been getting me down, some of them are extremely, shall we say, prosaic compared to the rather weighty events in India, which I've just been discussing. But nonetheless, they've been getting me down. You know, they strike very, very close to home. And one is that, you know, you've heard me ranting about it on the air before. My favorite bagel place is well and truly gone. It's not coming back. They aren't just on vacation. They really did shut down. I asked some of the other local merchants on Houston Street, and they're gone. So, you know, they're really, there's hardly any good bagel joints left in the East Village. It's a terrible state of affairs. It really is. Just awful. And, you know, the people there were really my buds, and I don't even know how to reach them anymore. You know, I was like one of the regulars there, and there were other regulars, and we all kind of got to know each other, and I would go there for a bagel, you know, like a couple of times a week, and, you know, just hang out with the regulars and shoot the breeze and talk politics, and, you know, now they're gone. It's just really, really unfortunate, not to mention the fact that they had really, really good bagels and really, really good music, as I said. So once again, just on the odd chance that anybody out there knows my good bud Sasha from the former Hot Bagels on Houston Street, right next door to Katz's Delicatessen, please tell him to get in touch with me here at the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, care of WBAI, 505 8th Avenue. No, it's not 505 8th Avenue. What am I saying? It's at 120 Wall Street. Oh, God. This shows you how old I am. It hasn't been at 505 8th Avenue for 10 years. So, okay, what else? You know, I had to go through during the few days of bitter, bitter cold. Of course, the heat went out in my apartment, so I had to, like, get on the horn and call 311 and complain, and it took, you know, like a few days for the heat to come back on, and by the time the heat was back on, it wasn't even that cold anymore. You know, the few days there was really bitterly cold, the heat was out. So, you know, just typical New York stuff. And, you know, you've also heard me rant on these airwaves before about Metro cards. And you know what? It drives me crazy that New Yorkers are not up in arms about this, because it happened to me yet again. And I tell people this and they tell me that I'm imagining things and I'm paranoid. But I swear, you know, when you use your Metro card and it doesn't take and you get a message saying, please swipe again. Well, every time you swipe again, you're being charged $2. Okay. Keep track of it, because I have been keeping track of it. And I, you know, believe me, I don't know about all the time, but some of the time when you have to swipe again, you're actually being charged again. So, you know, Metro cards are just a total absolute scam, absolute atrocity. And it's just one of the, you know, small ways in which, you know, our whole civilization and our whole culture is just going downhill. You know, we never had this problem with tokens. Nobody ever said, please swipe again with a token. And you didn't have to worry about whether you were being, you know, ripped off for the for a fare by having to, you know, swipe again with a token, right? A total non-issue. There was absolutely nothing wrong with the status quo ante. But, of course, we can never go back to it. And even the fact that I'm mentioning it makes me, you know, ridiculous, backward-looking, reactionary, Luddite, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, and on a similarly, similarly petty theme, you might say. Another, like, small thing which, you know, sort of got me down is, okay, I consume a lot of honey, especially in the winter. You know, I put a lot of honey in my tea. I drink tea all night, stay up working, and put a lot of honey in it. And it keeps me going. And I believe that honey has curative properties. I believe that it helps ward off colds in the winter. I really truly believe that. And when I use a lot of honey, I tend to stay healthy. And when I don't have honey and I put sugar in my tea instead, I tend to get colds more easily. So I'm a firm believer in the curative properties of honey. And consequently, I buy a lot of honey. And I buy it in the large size. You know, you get like a gallon of honey for $15 if you buy it in that size. And you can no longer get honey in that size in a glass jar. Only in a plastic jar now. And this is like, you know, a recent development. They've completely phased out. Everywhere where I used to go to get my honey, you know, one by one by one, they started switching from glass to plastic. And now, finally, the last place where I went, on Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn, where I could still get it in glass, they just switched to plastic. So I'm having to buy my honey in plastic now. And you would think, well, you know, who cares? What difference does it make? Well, it does make a difference. For starters, it just makes a difference on an aesthetic level, because, you know, I mean, you can actually see the honey clearly through the glass, and it looks nice, and you know, it kind of looks homey, and the plastic just looks, you know, cheap and sterile. But beyond that, I mean, plastic is a carcinogen. It's made from oil. And I don't particularly feel like, you know, eating food which has been hanging around in plastic for too long. So, you know, again, it's just a little thing. But, you know, it's the fact that it is a little thing is what kind of, in a weird way, makes it a big thing for me, because here we are so concerned with the fact that the economy is falling apart And the fact that, you know, India and Pakistan could be going to war, and the fact that, you know, we've got global warming and we're running out of oil and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, all of those big things kind of squeeze the little things like metro cards and plastic packaging off of the radar screen to a certain extent. But really, it's fundamentally a part of the same problem, right? I mean, plastic is made from oil. This is just, you know, another symptom of the hypertrophy of the oil economy, which is the same thing which is driving U.S. intervention in the Middle East and the whole, you know, depressing GWAT versus jihad dynamic, the, you know, global war on terrorism versus militant Islam, which is really a struggle for control of the world's oil, of course. And it's what's driving, you know, global warming and climate destabilization and global ecological collapse. So ultimately, it's all part of the same problem, right? So, you know, it's these little things which are symptoms of the larger problem, which really kind of, you know, they kind of add up to a big whopping winter depression. And I do have to keep on telling myself that to a certain extent, this is just a, the fact that I've been really depressed is just a function of the time of year, because I always get depressed as the days get shorter and sort of have this sense of impending doom. And I think it, you know, it's just like a deep genetic thing. And it goes back to when, you know, people thought the world was coming to an end when the days got shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter. Back in very, very ancient times. I don't know. Is that true? Did people ever really think that the world was coming to an end? Well, it sort of feels like the world is coming to an end to me until finally the days do start to get longer. And then I can at least feel like, well, yeah, maybe eventually one day it's going to be spring again. Right. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's at least within hoping distance. Can actually start looking forward to spring after the new year, but it's too early to be looking forward to spring before Christmas. And you know, still, I, you know, it's just the sense that unlike the seasons coming back, tokens aren't coming back, right? I mean, one day it's going to be spring again, but we're never going to have tokens again. You know, it's like an endangered species. Once it's gone, it's gone. And probably, you know, I'm going to have to get used to the fact that, you know, honey is never going to be available in gallon size in glass jars again. And probably you're not going to be able to get honey in any size in glass jars in the years to come. It's just going to be plastic, plastic, plastic all the way. Although I dare to hope that maybe, you know, with the fundamental changes which appear like they're on the horizon, maybe it'll actually extend to the level that, you know, once again, plastic is going to get pushed off the market a few years down the line, and that natural products like glass are going to come back. Maybe. And certainly, you know, there have been some glimmers of hope out there. All of this talk about they're going to have to appoint a car czar for the Detroit bailout. Well, that doesn't go nearly far enough, of course. Detroit should be nationalized, and the entire industry should be subject to public control and public direction, and all of those jobs should be put into a so-called Green New Deal, as some people are talking about, and actually creating the technologies which we are going to need to get off, to decouple ourselves from the oil economy. But still, at least it's at least now you can these ideas, perhaps you can actually talk about them now. They can enter the mainstream at last, right? If they're actually talking about some kind of, you know, public control over the auto industry, then maybe, you know, ideas like a Green New Deal can actually at least be on the, they can at least be on the, within the spectrum of legitimate debate, right? So maybe, you know, if there's enough pressure from below, maybe there actually can be, if we, enough pressure on President Obama that we can actually, we can actually take over Detroit. And certainly there have been some other significant glimmers of hope out there. Those workers out in Chicago who actually took over their factory in order to get their severance pay appear to have won their struggle. It was a very heroic stance on their part. And it seems just today that the bank who was underwriting the company, Bank of America, has caved. And it looks like they're going to get their severance pay and their vacation pay. So it seems like, you know, they won. They took a stance. They occupied their factory just like the workers in Flint, Michigan did in 1936. And they won. So that gives me hope. That really, really does give me hope. So there have been a few things out there which have given me some hope. And maybe people will call in. Maybe we'll take some phone calls, and people out there can give me some more glimmers of hope, if you feel that there are any glimmers of hope on the landscape. Like those workers in Detroit who won their struggle, and in Chicago, who won their struggle, and the Muslims who marched against terrorism in India. Maybe there's some other glimmers of hope out there. And you never know where you're going to encounter a glimmer of hope. So if anybody else out there has some glimmers of hope for me, in particular, you're encouraged to call. Or if you just want to call and diss me and tell me that I'm condescending because I don't buy your wacky conspiracy theories, well, I can't stop you from doing that. 212-209-2900. 212-209-2900. In just about 5 minutes, we'll take your phone calls. So hang on to what you have to say. We're going to take your phone calls in about 5 minutes. 212-209-2900 in about 5 minutes. But first, I have one more thing to say about glimmers of hope and how they can come from the most unlikely of sources. And here's one thing I saw recently which gave me a glimmer of hope. Here's a clue. Yeah, no kidding. Did anybody else out there see Quantum of Solace, the new James Bond movie, which I am calling Quantum of Anti-Imperialism? It was the first left-wing James Bond movie. James Bond saves Evo Morales, the first indigenous president and socialist president of Bolivia, from a CIA-sponsored coup d'etat. Now, if this is not a sign of shifting zeitgeist, I don't know what is. truly remarkable. I mean, this is James Bond, License to Kill, you know, obvious, you know, glorification of Cold War spycraft and British imperialism has gone over to the good guys. Astounding. Astounding. So the bad guys in this movie are it's a private corporation, which is sort of a hybrid of Blackwater and Bechtel, which is scheming to take over Bolivia with the connivance of the CIA. Now, they're like Blackwater because they're, they've got their own private armies and mercenary operations, and they can basically, they've got enough wherewithal to pull off the coup d'etat on their own, basically. And they can destabilize any government at will. And in fact, their staging ground for the coup d'etat that they're planning in Bolivia is none other than Haiti. And they actually make a reference. Now, they don't actually reference either Evo Morales or Jean-Bertrand Aristide by name. But it's very, very clear, very, very, very clear who they're talking about. So when they're staging the coup d'etat in Bolivia, when they're actually staging the coup d'etat that they've got planned for Bolivia in Haiti, they say, well, we did it here. There was, this populist priest who came to power who raised the minimum wage. And the corporations who run the sweatshops down here didn't like that, so they hired us in to pull off a coup d'etat. An obvious reference to Aristide, and an obvious reference to what really did happen in Haiti, not just once, but twice, by the way. There was the Cedras coup back in the 1990s, and then there was the more recent coup when Aristide was ousted for a second, and it seems final time. So they actually reference the coup d'etat in Haiti and then say, oh, and we're going to do the same thing in Bolivia, and here's where the Bechtel angle comes in, because they're doing it to, they want to seize control of Bolivia's water supply and stick it to the suffering Quechua Indian peasants of Bolivia by jacking up their water rates and squeezing the country for all that it's worth. And of course, that's exactly what happened in Bolivia. There was the so-called Cochabamba water war just a couple of years ago, where the Bechtel Corporation of California moved into Bolivia and seized control through a contract of the water supply in the department of Cochabamba. And when the rates got jacked up, when the water rates got jacked up, the people of Cochabamba took up arms, and there was a mass insurrection, and finally Bechtel was forced to leave, and they fled the country. So it's obviously a reference to that. So this is the most, not only one of the most realistic and didactic James Bond movies that we've ever seen, but it's got thoroughly left-wing politics. So this company, which is, again, this sort of hybrid of Blackwater and Bechtel, is plotting to bump off Evo Morales and put the reactionary generals back in power in Bolivia with the connivance of the CIA. And the CIA guy, well, there's the good CIA guy. What's Bond's sidekick in the CIA, who's like his friend and his contact in the CIA? I can't remember his name at the moment, but you all know the character I'm talking about. He's the one who's like kind of okay. But then there's the other CIA guy who's just, this really sinister, smarmy, evil guy who makes your skin crawl, who's like in bed with this Blackwater, Black Bechtel type outfit, which is trying to overthrow the Bolivian government and assuring them that, okay, you'll have the CIA's support in your coup d'etat, go ahead. And James Bond and his lovely sidekick save the day. So amazing. And by the way, his lovely sidekick, the Bond girl, quote unquote, is a Bolivian secret agent. She's a secret agent for Evo Morales. And in what's almost vaguely, by the standards of the Bond movies, feminist politics, he doesn't even sleep with her. He doesn't even go to bed with her. And she's kind of like, he does save her life at the end, but he doesn't actually go to bed with her. And she's a really heroic character in her own right. So, incredible. So that kind of, to me, that symbolizes that maybe we're at a moment of zeitgeist shift, when even the James Bond movies have like, you know, come around and have got a left-wing anti-imperialist slant. Maybe, you know, the Reagan era is really over, and maybe we're just entering something new, and maybe there really are going to be some possibilities opening up. What do you all have to say about that? 212-209-2900. If anybody has anything to say any of the things we've been touching on tonight, we'll take your calls. 212-209-2900. While you're all calling in, okay, that was the John Barry Orchestra version of the James Bond theme, which I believe is the more classical version, the original version. But let's hear the Monty Norman Orchestra's version of the James Bond theme while we give you all a chance to call in at 212-209-2900. See, let's decide which one we like better. Well, definitely somewhat more pronounced guitar work on the Monty Norman Orchestra version. Maybe we like that one a little bit better. Maybe some of you real aficionados can tell us which films the respective versions were used in, the John Barry version or the Monty Norman version. And a big shout-out, by the way, to Rat Girl of the West for laying this wonderful music on the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Maybe one day we'll see you again, Rat Girl. Meanwhile, let's take some listener phone calls, shall we? Anybody out there see the new James Bond movie? Anything to say about it? WBAI, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Yes, I believe you consider yourself someone who speaks directly.
I try to.
Okay, now, when you're referring, I know what you mean, but when you say James Bond did not go to bed with someone.
Well, forgive my lapse into euphemism.
Right.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
Why?
Anything else to say?
Why not use CIA allowed and FCC allowed terminology?
Oh, boy. Do you have anything else to say? We're going to move on. WBAI, you're on the air. Turn down your radio and speak up. Turn down your radio. Look, you all know the program. Turn down the radio. Be near the radio when you call in so you can turn it down as soon as you hear my voice on the telephone and we don't have to waste time. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hey there.
Hi.
I'm wondering about the auto industry. I want to ask you, when you say the auto industry should be nationalized, why do you say that?
Why do I say that? Because they certainly made a big mess of it in private hands.
Yeah.
I believe that those resources need to be subject to social direction. And in particular, they need to be subject to a complete redirection and actually, you know, putting those resources, that money, that infrastructure to work, getting us off of the oil economy, just as they were put to work for the antisocial aim of getting us on to the oil economy.
Gotcha. Then we could regulate the industry a little better.
I would say we should go. See, now they're talking about government regulation. I say that we should go beyond regulation and just take it over, put it in public hands.
Right.
Direct it, not regulate it, but direct it.
What are some other industries that are directed by the government? Like,
well, there aren't any because this is America. You're not supposed to talk that way in America.
Right.
But maybe that's going to change in the years to come.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I hope so.
Yeah, because we seem to be at some kind of a turning point here.
Well, sounds like it.
Okay, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
WBAI, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, this is something that's kind of been under the radar, but I don't know if you heard about it, but Police Commissioner Kelly has now instituted a training period for rookie cops where they're going to be trained how to use heavy weapons, meaning automatic weapons. And if you thought the Sean Bell shooting was bad, wait until they put machine guns in the hands of rookie cops in the city. And I think that that's something that we need to kind of take notice of and oppose.
I certainly agree. There is some bad news.
Well, the good news is that the cops that raped Michael Mineo in the subway station were arrested today.
Yes, I know. Yeah, that is good news.
That is good news. Yeah. Okay, see you.
Thank you. WBAI, you're on the air.
Captain Lozoff, what?
Excuse me?
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, I have a few things. One, do you know why or how or when Bombay was changed to Mumbai, whatever?
Recently, because the Indians got tired of using a British malapropism. That's why. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi.
WBAI, you're on the air. Okay, we've had two pretty good calls and two really bad ones. Two for two. WBAI, you're on the air. No, now we're three for two. WBAI, you're on the air.
Okay, and first off, if you ever tried the bagel shop on Avenue A next to Key Food?
You know, that actually is a pretty good place.
Yes, it is.
It's just about the only good one left in the neighborhood, to tell you the truth. But for starters, they charge a dollar more for a bagel with... well, my favorite spread, which happens to be either vegetable spread or olive spread, than the other place did. And also, it's trendy and crowded. You know, you've got all these people there with their laptops, and you can never get a seat. And the other place was much more of a real working-class neighborhood kind of place.
Yeah, it is, but it's black-run. The guys are from Africa, and they're really, really nice cats.
That's true. That's very true, yeah.
All right, number one. Yeah. Number two... On the auto industry, I'm in favor of doing away with cars. And, yeah, I agree, not only turning the auto industry over to the workers, but expropriating the industry and doing away with cars altogether, bringing back trolleys under a socialist society, which is the only way to really do it.
I'm with you.
You can't. Because you got people... You got people on the left calling for nationalization of the auto industry under capitalism. And you really do be affecting it to smash the capitalist state.
Well, yes, I know. I agree. I suppose. But, once again, I'm going to take what I can get. If there can be a certain degree of social oversight of the industry, which can be wrested from the capitalist system without actually smashing the capitalist system, I'll settle for that.
But then the workers have to occupy the plants like they did in the late 30s.
Right, and like those workers in Chicago just did this week.
I didn't know about that.
Well, check it out.
I'm glad I heard about that. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, later. Bye.
WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello, BAI.
Yep. You're on
Hello?
The air. You're on the air.
Okay, just one quick thing about nationalization. It's not going to happen because the federal government would have to assume the debts of the auto companies, and they're not going to do that.
But they're doing that anyway. That's what it's all about. The federal government is coming in to the rescue as the financial sugar daddy, but they're saying, well, you know, you guys are going to have to give up some stuff too, so we're going to appoint this car czar. So they're already doing that. It's just a question of how much Detroit is going to have to give up.
Well, how could you elaborate on that? Because how are they assuming the debts now?
Well, they're giving a so-called bridge loan, which pretty much amounts to the same thing. You know, they're giving a bridge loan until the industry can theoretically get back on its feet and pay it back. So instead, instead, if they took it over, then the government would actually have the assets, and then they could, you know, direct it as they, or being optimistic, since we ostensibly live in a democracy, the way we see fit, and get the money back that way. Make the money back doing something logical and good for society and good for the planet, as opposed to something pathological, bad for society, bad for the planet.
I see. Okay, well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
I like the show.
Thank you.
Have a good night.
You too.
Bye.
WBAI, you're on the air. Turn down the radio. Speak up.
Yes, hello?
You're on the air.
Yes, okay. I wanted to talk about the Metro cards.
Please.
Because it's true that, like, they take people's fares, but what you have to do is go back to the clerk and let them know, or keep account of your fares. But most people don't do that during rush hour time.
Exactly.
And then what it is like, because I work for trains. I'm not going to say what tour I work for. And I tell them, I said, yeah, I mean, like, I'll correct people through. But what happened is that some people don't go and try to get their $2 back. So what happens is that transit keeps their $2.
Yes, I know. That's what I'm ranting about.
And I tell people, you have to go and complain.
But why should I have to? I never had to do that with tokens.
I know you don't, but this is what they wanted to do with the cards and everything.
It's a scam. I'm sorry. It's a scam.
It is. And the thing is that's how they get their surplus.
Yeah, exactly. In the meantime, they want to raise the fare.
Yeah. And
Come on, it's such a scam.
Yeah. And the thing is that I remember I was complaining one time about, I guess, how the people were treated, and a supervisor told me, why are you aiding the enemy? I said, I didn't know the riding public was the enemy.
There you go.
Yeah.
That tells volumes.
And that's the thing, what they do. It's like the supervision that goes on here. So it's like it's how these cars. It's how the cars, and they're not biodegradable.
Right, that too, exactly.
Yeah, and I'm saying, why not the EP?
Tokens were recycled. Tokens were recycled, right?
Yeah.
I think the landfills are going to be filled up with these Metro cards, you know, as the years go by. I'm sorry, I'm against it.
I'm against it too, but they're not going to go back, you know, because they get a lot of money from these cards. I mean, not the work is super. I mean,
I know what you mean. Exactly. So you acknowledge it's a scam. You agree with me that it's a scam.
Yeah.
Glad to hear it.
And I complain to supervisors, and they won't say nothing. They just, you know, they won't say anything about.
Well, I'm vindicated. I'm glad to hear this, even though it's depressing, because it vindicates it vindicates my cynicism.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else?
Your music is great.
Thank you.
Your music is great.
Which the classical ragas or the James Bond?
the Indian.
Yeah.
Right?
Good stuff.
James Bond too. Yeah, I saw the picture also. Yeah.
Okay. Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
WBAI, you're on the air. Turn down your radio and speak up.
Yeah. Hi. Yeah. I've just been. You know, I'm an ex New York City person. I was born there, and I've been up here. About 70 miles away from the city for about 20 years. I had to leave because we just couldn't afford living there anymore. But that was around the time, the late 80s, when the 80s were really roaring and it got ridiculous. And I'm afraid that, not to be pessimistic, but it seems that it's the nature of cities that all these, quote, wonderful, innovative things will be first visited upon them, you know, in terms of experimentation. And the, and those Metro cards are one glaring example. You know, the others are the taxi cabs that will never shut up and things like that, you know. But and I think that I'm not coining a word, but I think of them, especially with Bloomberg in offices, the corporatistas are extremely centralized and they get these huge contracts to perpetrate whatever malevolence they feel like perpetrating. I think it's a really rough time to live in a major city, especially New York, because it seems to suffer more indignities than what seems to be still a good town like Chicago, for instance. You know, Chicago is in the thrall of all this modern nonsense. In other words, you know, it seems to be
maybe it's not as advanced in Chicago as it is here. But
that's what I'm saying. But advanced is a relative term.
Exactly.
I'm talking about corporatistas doing really stupid things and experimenting upon millions of people.
Yeah, well, I mean, Chicago has certainly been subject to the same, issues of gentrification and displacement and so on as New York City has, believe me. Probably, it's, as I say, not as advanced there as it is here. Anyway, let's move on. Thanks for the call. WBAI, you're on the air. You're on the air.
Why are you condescending?
You're the first person tonight who's accused me of that, so maybe we'll just move on. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, Bill.
Yes.
Yeah, on the honey front, have you tried one of the local farmers markets?
Oh, yeah, that's true. There still is the farmers markets. That's true, the Union Square farmers market. But
and also in Brooklyn there's farmers markets. Right,
right, but the one which is convenient for me because I live in the East Village is...
I'm sorry. Yeah, Union Square has excellent that's honey
true.
In glass.
That's true. Well, okay, glad to hear it. Although... I think even some of the people there have switched to plastic recently, and also the price there is not quite as good. It's just like $17 for a gallon as opposed to $15.
Well, yeah, we do have to exercise like consumer demand too, in that like in my local health food store, they started selling apple juice in gallons in plastic. People stopped buying it. And then a few months later, it was back in glass. So,
on. A victory for the people.
tell the guys when you see them selling it in glass that say, look, this is the only way you're going to buy it. You're not going to buy it unless it's in glass.
I know. Well, believe me, I did at all the places where I usually shop, and they just tell me, well, that's just the way, they don't make it that way anymore.
Well, the farmer's markets, you can speak to the grower
himself.
Right,
that's totally true. That's totally true.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
WBAI, you're on the air.
Thanks so much for taking my call.
Yeah, turn down your radio and speak up, please.
What I wanted to talk about was the possibility of of doing a people's movement using the internet to. Let me do it this way. Have you ever taken a look at the site, the hungersite.com?
I'm sorry, hungersite.com?
Yes.
I haven't.
Okay, what it is, it's a site in which people sponsor or show their wares. A lot of it is local or cooperative owned. And what they do is if you go on the site, you get a chance to donate a certain amount of food or health care by just clicking and looking at the site.
I'll check it out, although I tend to be a little bit skeptical about all these, internet utopian solutions. On the subject, though, I'll point out, what's the name of this Good Search? Apparently, you can actually, if you use Good Search as your search engine, you can actually donate money to BAI, like pennies, every time you do a search.
I suppose
we should be aggressively appealing to our listeners who are internet mavens.
I have been asking
to do that.
Asking. Yeah. I'm going to come down and ask them to put a sign up in the control room. And I came up with a game, Bill, and because you have a lot of esoteric things that come on your show, it would be interesting if you would be willing to run a game and have people use Good Search and put BAI in as a charity. And then come back to you with the answers. And
send me an email about it, or
I'll come down and volunteer next week.
Okay, very good. Come down and volunteer next week, and we'll talk about it in the flesh. Very good. Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes. Hello. I don't know. I tuned in late to your program tonight, so I don't know if you've discussed this at all. But perhaps you've heard in the news lately for the past 2 weeks that they want to put tolls on all the East River bridges. Have you heard about that?
Of course I've heard about it.
And what we're getting is this information or misinformation, I believe, that it's because the state or the city or whatever needs money. But I think that it's deeper than that. I think it's because they just want to keep all the unwashed masses out of their domain of their own place that they've claimed now, the gentrified and Disneyfied crowd of Manhattan.
Well, again, I don't want to think conspiratorially about it, but I do think that ultimately that's the trend. Whether that's the intention or not, that is the trend. And that's why ultimately I have to say I'm against it. Although, like when I listen to WNYC, they've been talking about it a lot on Brian Lehrer. And they even had, you know, Richard Ravitch, who's the author of the plan, you know, plugging it and people calling in. And all the people who call in and are speaking, for it, are people who really, sound very appealing and people who I, you know, would kind of see eye to eye with about a lot of things. And they're talking about how we have to get off of cars and, you know, clean air and blah, 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 and mass transit and blah, blah, blah. And all the people who are speaking, against it are people who are just kind of like reactionary Neanderthals and is, oh, my right to drive and I can drive wherever I want to and blah, 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 blah. And yet, ultimately, I think I'm against it for exactly the reason that you say, because it's just kind of, you know, sort of enforcing this New York City apartheid and just turning Manhattan into a playground island for the rich And it does, you know, I mean, it does disproportionately hurt working people, you know, without a doubt.
Absolutely. Yeah. I couldn't agree with you more. But it's interesting that you pointed out to me that the people you think who are for it are against it, and the people who are against it, you know, they use the whole green front or something. Or
well, it's not a green front. I mean, you know, they're I don't think it's a front. I don't think they're being dishonest. I just think that, you know, they're only looking at one side of the question, and they're not, you know, grappling with the arguments which you've just raised. I don't think they're being disingenuous.
No, I know what you mean, but we're both in agreement that it's another step towards.
Yeah, unfortunately, it is. Although I. Like I say, you know, these people who think that it's their God-given right to drive anywhere are really a drag too, you know. So I feel like we've got some kind of, even though I'm against it, I feel more comfortable with my opponents than my allies on this issue, if you know what I mean.
Right. I guess we could leave it at that for now, and maybe somebody else would want to call up about it.
Yeah, okay. Well, we're actually almost out of time.
Oh, all right.
But maybe we can squeeze in one or two more calls if people just keep it to the point.
Very good.
WBAI, you're on the air.
Hey!
Well, he certainly keeps it to the point. I don't know what his point is, but he keeps to it. WBAI, you're on the air.
When you vote for Obama, you
get Oh, come on. Don't you know, you people, you one-trick ponies. Don't you have anything else to say? I mean, is this how you get your jollies? I don't get it. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention a very interesting book. It's by Robert Zubrin called Energy Victory. And he talks about if Congress passed a law forcing all new cars to be flex-fueled, we can get, within maybe 5 years, 50 million cars on the road with this flex-fuel, capability of either alcohol and a combination of alcohol and gasoline.
Well, look, I believe that such solutions certainly need to be explored. But hang on a second. I believe that such solutions certainly need to be explored, but I also think that there's dangers there, and one of them is that it requires building new cars, which is itself, you know, a tremendous waste of resources and energy. And I want to get cars off the road, ultimately, right? It's not just a question of what they burn, it's a question of the fact that they exist. But all that said, what exactly are flex fuels?
Cars that are capable of running any combination of gasoline and the various forms of alcohol, methanol, ethanol, and he basically states that we can grow all the fuel we want.
Right.
Not through corn, but things like hemp, for instance.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't matter whether it's corn or hemp. You're still diverting croplands from growing food to growing fuel. And that's you know, been responsible in large part for the huge spike in food prices that we've seen this year, which has sparked, you know, riots and uprisings all over the world. So I'm a little bit suspicious about this this notion. But thank you for your call. Maybe we have time for one or two more. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
No. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hi. You know, I you mentioned earlier about nationalizing the auto industry. Not a bad idea, but as you maybe you'll agree, maybe you won't. This is not the most democratic country in the world. So with the government directing things, maybe wouldn't turn out too well. How about cooperatively organized enterprise? Maybe it'd be better.
Certainly I share your misgivings. I mean, going from private capitalism to state capitalism, as it were, is not necessarily progress. It's a lateral move at best. But, at a minimum, you know, now we're capable of putting, I think, for the first time since the Reagan era, we're capable of putting these ideas out on the table for discussion and for them to actually be perhaps taken seriously. And, maybe with a lot of pressure from below and, you know, people doing things like taking over the auto plants, like in Flint, Michigan in 1936, as under the New Deal, perhaps under a Green New Deal, there could actually be, you know, a greater sense of social direction and populist thrust to the policies than there would be if things were just left to their own devices without pressure from below. All right. All good calls tonight, except for the few one-trick ponies who felt compelled to call in for mysterious reasons. I don't understand their mentality, but whatever. So thank you for all of the intelligent calls that we got, which was the big majority. Thank you. And I don't know, no women called, all guys. What a sausage fest. Well, maybe some women will call next week. Well, no, next week we're going to be pitching, right? So do tune in next week. And if you appreciate the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade and you appreciate WBAI, please do, if you're not a member of this radio station, please be prepared to become a member of this radio station. Put your shoulder to the wheel next week because it's very, very important. This has been the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade on listener-supported, non-commercial, WBAI, 99.5 FM in New York City. My name is Bill Weinberg, and this has been, I just said, the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. And stay tuned for Weaponry with Tom Whisker coming up next. And I'll tell you what, we're going to go out as we came in once again with the golden voice of Shruti Sadolikar Katkar. See you next week. And in solidarity with Mumbai, once again, namaste and salam aleikum.
Remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.